Don't let school take you out of the real world. Never lose touch with what's going on outside of the classroom. One of the big problems we face is that kids are taken out of anything resembling a real world for 4 years for college, and they've lost that perceptive power of entrepreneurship because they don't have any connection to what's really going on in the real world anymore. Don't let school take you out of the real world.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the podcast. Today we continue our Liberty Forum series with Jeffrey Tucker, the primus inter pares, a job title that will be explained during the show of the Laissez-Faire Club. I have to tell you, this was one of my all-time favorite interviews. I definitely look forward to an opportunity to have Jeffrey Tucker on the show. Again, I will make sure all of his stuff is linked up in the show notes if you want to check out more of his work. What are we talking about? You know who Jeffrey Tucker is, but I highly recommend his blog, and this was just terrific. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. The interview never really has a starting point. We just sit down, check our mics, and start talking. So here we go. Jeffrey Tucker at the 2013 Liberty Forum. Thanks for listening, everyone, and take care. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3.
Test. Whoa, that's loud. Yeah.
You look good. That looks good.
Yeah. Okay.
And you look good.
Okay. Are we on
your
camera?
Levels look
we're
good.
Not on camera.
No, we're not on. We're not on camera.
Okay. Okay.
Real simple setup. I'm on 3 hours of sleep. You know, we don't have a makeup team.
Okay.
No cameras.
Good. Okay.
Check
good.
Yours, Osborne.
Check.
Everyone looks about the same. So do you mind if we ask some background questions?
Sure.
This is what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
If you go to your Wikipedia page, right?
Right.
It says in quotes that you were a roofer, a truck driver. And it's in quotes.
Does it really? What does it mean, in quotes? I don't even know. I haven't been on my Wikipedia page
Have you
in
ever
a
been
year.
A roofer?
Yeah, I was a roofer.
Okay, all right. So it says roofer, like odd jobs, kind of... What else? Bricklayer?
That's funny. Yeah, no, I never did bricklaying. I wished I had.
Maintenance?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, box crusher and toilet cleaner and everything, yeah.
So there's a story between now and then, and I don't know if you...
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay, well, so I started working when I was very young because I always loved kind of work, right?
Yeah.
I did roofing. I drilled water wells, which was great. I moved organs and repaired organs. This is all when I was a teenager, you know, that sort of thing.
Wait, like the musical instrument.
Yeah. Not on the black market.
No, right.
Okay, all right.
No, I went to, you know, set up an organ lofts and tuned the organs, you know, repaired pipe organs. That was a great job. You know, back in the day, though, you could, you know, take those kind of jobs, and they were always available to you. Mm-hmm. People weren't checking your papers, and there wasn't a lot of enforcement. That wasn't too long ago, but, you know, there was a lot of, most businesses would pay you in cash, and even if they didn't, nobody was checking child labor laws, you know? It wasn't that big a deal. So, you know, if you were young, if you were 12, 13, 14, and wanted to work, you could get a job. Now it's much more difficult. Most companies wouldn't even take the risk of the enforcement of the child labor laws.
Oh, so that was, you're talking about like when you were a teenager, before you were even what would be legal work age.
Oh, yeah, sure. Right.
All right, because, you know, I'm picturing you as an adult doing these things. And then I see this man before me here today who's very polished. And, like, honestly, before I learned about, I'm obviously been familiar with the name for a while, but, you know, you see your presentation, you hear you speak a couple sentences, you say, oh, this man is a professor at Oxford.
Right.
But then it says, roofer.
Well, I haven't looked at that page in years, so I have no idea what it says. I should really probably check it out.
Yeah, but it appears as if it's a quote from you.
Okay.
You were
okay.
Giving like a resume.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did this interview sometime with I think I did an interview on a website somewhere where I talked about some of these jobs. And basically, I'm an advocate of putting children to work as young as possible. I think a good age to start work is 12, really. Because you don't learn a damn thing in school, really. But you learn a lot of things from work. You learn how to you know, get along with others and how to, you know, evaluate your own contribution to the firm. You understand the relationship between time and money. You learn from the people you're working with, and you learn about accounting and service to others, the discipline associated with arriving on time and working hard. And And it's good for kids to be in an adult environment, I think. You know, this idea of a kind of isolated teen world where there's a bubble where you just influence each other is really kind of crazy. It really has nothing to do with reality. So I'd like to see kids going to work, you know, part-time, even full-time, you know, at the age of 12 or something like that. And then, you know, our whole system is reversed because now the federal government allows you to start more or less really working at the age of 16. Yes, you can do it at 14, 15, but not really. Not
right,
really.
Right.
I mean, we all know that that's kind of a hoax. Yes, there's so much paperwork and so many exceptions. Basically, 16 is the legal working age. And
even that is almost impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was 16, I remember putting out hundreds and hundreds of applications and never getting anything. But
that's
on
right.
my 18th birthday, I remember the phone started ringing off the hook.
Yeah.
From all these hundreds of applications that I had turned in 2 years previously.
Yeah, people are worried. Yeah, even at 16, I think you can't work during school hours and things like that. So, yeah, there's all these restrictions, and it's a little bit nutty. I like any business that's willing to hire, you know, kids today. Far from prosecuting them, I think they're heroic. I mean, you know, the Department of Labor is terrible on businesses that hire kids. And, you take a risk with a 16-year-old. But now, if you think about it, look at the way the reality works nowadays for teenagers. At the age of 16, they should be thinking about maybe college, maybe, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that would be the typical thing.
That would be the normal thing.
Right.
Should they be thinking about it? It really
maybe,
depends.
Maybe yeah. not. But if they are, they need to be starting to think about academics, right? They
sure.
need to be sort of burrowing down into their studies. They need to be taking that SAT, which is a lot of time and energy spent. Studies, ramping up on the calculus. I mean, really digging into their academic studies. So probably this is the time when it's not the best idea to have, you know, like a part-time job. You know, there's probably enough to do at the ages from 16 to 18 to prepare yourself for academics, if that's what you're going to be doing.
Sure.
To excuse you from work. Well, that's the time when they're just first permitted to work. But the ages from 12 to 16, most, you know, especially boys, it's probably true for girls, they're wasting their time doing absolutely nothing. They've already learned, you know, probably all they're going to get from school anyway.
Yeah.
They should be working. That's the time when the government doesn't allow them to work. By the time they're allowed to work, they should probably be focused in on, you know, more specific things related to the academic life if that's what they're going to be doing. So we've got the whole system, like, upside down. And also, by the age of 16, most kids are involved in all these other extracurricular things. You know, they've got basketball, and they've got soccer, and they've got chess club, and they've got, you know, the choir, and they've got the band, and they've figured out ways to fill up their life with a bunch of crap.
Yeah, and they've got parents above them in black helicopters, you know, yeah. swirling around yeah. with the spotlights, making sure. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
The reason why I just want to stop there and add
yeah.
this. We talked about this a lot on my show. The age 12 to 16, most kids during that time, they're in middle school, which is like a very, very dark time
yeah,
in a person's life.
Yeah, it's a dreadful time.
When you're in elementary school, yeah, okay, there's paint, there's clay. Adults are very big and impressive. They
right.
can drive, they can cook for you. When you're in high school, I think you're kind of over that. You're full grown.
Yeah.
You can have a job. You can drive a car. You can have a girlfriend. You can have some sex. But that period in the middle where you can start to kind of see that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, but you're so far away from it and you're just stuck in that place filling out worksheets. Yeah, I've never just walked that over from saying, this is a terrible time. They should be at work.
Wouldn't it be so great if they could be actually working, you know, at anywhere, like fast food or whatever? Like in my case, you know, I had like tons of really cool jobs and I learned so much from them, you know, and I feel really bad. It's really child abuse the way we just deny these kids access to doing valuable things.
Yeah.
It's like
yeah.
we tell them, no, it is not legal for you to make any contribution whatsoever to the social order or to yourself. And you certainly can't make money. And, you know, look, it's nowadays, if you get a kid involved in any kind of business at all at that age, it's got to be for charitable reasons. Like, so, you know, so this happens in my neighborhood all the time. You know, some kid will come up and they're trying to sell me something. And they'll say, well, I'm selling this thing, or, you know, please buy my lemonade. I'm giving the proceeds to, you know, this the latest humanitarian cause or whatever. Mm. And I always say to them, look, I'll buy your thing, but only if you keep the money. You know? Why would you want to give away your earnings, you fool?
Right.
But it's like the culture, you know, tells these kids that you're not allowed to earn a profit. You're not allowed to do anything that's beneficial for yourself. There shouldn't be any relationship between what you do and what you earn in life. That is pathetic.
That's true, too. Like, I remember selling those chocolate bars. They come in the box. It's like a kit, like fundraising kit to make money with chocolate. They didn't even pay us commission. And we were, you know, walking up and down in residential developments, you know, going around house to house trying to sell these. We weren't paid anything.
Yeah. And what are you learning from that, really? I mean, you're learning that, you know, it's like a slave job or something, like, you know, all your effort goes to something other than yourself, to benefit you.
Sure.
Maybe it's to raise money for, you know, the local organization or whatever. But mostly these days, people are giving away this money to idiotic, far-flung causes that really don't amount to anything.
Well,
so it's
like
just terrible.
Flushing the money down the toilet, too, because, I mean, how much money can you make selling chocolate bars door to door?
Right.
It's not very much. And not only are they handing it all over, but it's a minuscule amount of money anyway.
Right.
It'd be better off if they could spend half hour mowing a lawn, buy the chocolate bars themselves, give them the money.
Here's the other thing about the mowing the lawn solution, and that is still open to people, but a lot of kids are not quite enterprising enough to do that. And also, it requires a lot of capital, actually, to be a lawn mower. You don't have to have the lawn mower because people aren't going to let you loan, you know. But, so there's a lot of investment in that. A much better solution, and again, it requires that people on their own go out and try to get these jobs, which not everybody's really cut out for that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, ideally, a child should be in a position to work in a kind of a group setting, you know, like to go to work in the local, you know, tire manufacturing plant or whatever, so they can see the whole range of skills that are required to go into the manufacturing process. I mean, how thrilling would that be, you know, at the age of 12 or 13 to go work for the Hyundai factory, you know, in Montgomery, where you get to see cars being assembled and you're running screws from one place to the other, you know, that's cool kind of work. Or to work in a, you know, a bread factory or any kind of industrial job where you get to see fabulous things being made. So you see, wow, this is where stuff comes from. And I played a part in it. I mean, you get an investment of yourself into the life, the economic life of your community and your country. That's a glorious thing. That prepares you for the future. But look what everybody says is so evil, right? They say, oh, no, that's, what do they call it? That's like sweatshop jobs.
Yeah, you know, that's immediately equated with child labor.
I don't understand it, because exactly the reverse is true. I mean, the things we only allow kids to do a narrow range of things, like mow lawns, not everybody's really cut out for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, most girls don't want to do that, for example. So we tell them, oh, well, then your job is to babysit. But to hell with all this stuff. I mean, girls are perfectly capable of working in, you know, in grocery stores or in fast food restaurants or any other kind of, you know, really, really nice job, you know, technology factories or, you know, just whatever, anything that's going on, agricultural jobs, whatever. I mean, anything that involves you in a community of work where you're in a position to kind of emulate the behaviors of others and become a better person and make a contribution to something outside of yourself.
I think that that's really great advice, and I'm kind of embarrassed that after 3 years we haven't had a conversation with this detail about kids being able to go to work and just the empowerment that exists in that.
Oh,
and do you think if we could jump on this anti-child labor bandwagon, like if we went down to a middle school with some protest signs that said, like, stop pre-algebra worksheet slavery, stop gym class slavery.
It's so true, and I think the kids would absolutely love it. You know, you think about the self-image that kids today, young teens develop. I mean, we as a society are telling them that they are useless unless they're strapped to a desk somewhere and repeating back what the dictator in front of them is telling them. That is a terrible message. I mean, we want kids to believe that they have value, then we have to give them valuable things to do.
Yeah.
And working and bringing home money, I mean, how great is that? If you could earn money between the ages of 12 and 16, 4 solid years of earning, and probably, you know, minimum wage is maybe a little too high. We've got to get rid of that too, you know. But if they're earning a few bucks an hour, you know, and they can call it their own and they can take pride in who they are and what they're doing, that's a great preparation for life.
Think about how early they could retire too. If you could start working at age 12. I mean, by the time you're 20, Yeah. When you're in your prime physical mental right. condition, you already have all those skills and knowledge built up. I mean, you can be awesome for 10 yeah. years and then have enough money to live on the rest of your freaking life.
I can't remember a single workday where I didn't learn something extremely valuable. And I find myself now, you know, reflecting more, way more on those early years, you know, involved in... a catering company I used to work for example, you know.
Yeah.
And gosh, you know, those memories are still very intense in my head, you know, looking at the sea of people, you know, we'd have served dinners for 2,500 to 3,000 people, you know. And the cleanup after that kind of dinner party is quite intense, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd take it on by myself, you know. So I'd be facing, you know, like... it's, you know, 7 feet of trays with like roast beef stuck on them, you know, and having to scrub it off with a blasting hose. You know, I feel really sorry for kids today. You know, I think back at those experiences, you know, just how fun it was to tackle such a monstrosity like that, you know, 7 feet high of messy, you know, stuck beef stuck on plates, you know, with butter smeared all over them and just the horror. And but it's a great challenge. You know, that's what a kid wants. It's like, here's a total disaster. It's up to you to clean it. Well, what do I need to do? Well, I need to strap on these thick rubber gloves and start blasting this hot water that's, you know, like 150 degrees, you know.
Yeah.
And scraping it with these knives. And, you know, it's like a great battle, you know. It's a great thing.
But it's because there's an incentive. I mean, right? It's not like you were like, if my school just had a class where I could peel roast beef off plates.
Yeah.
You know, it's because you had a financial incentive.
It was the financial incentive. Yeah, I think it was the financial incentive and also the sense that I was doing something real.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw that crowd of 3,000 eaters, you know? I saw them when they sat down. I remembered helping prepare the meat, you know?
Yeah.
And serving it to them. And then I saw them, you know, gorging it down. And then they were happy. And then I'm left with the mess. And so I can see this kind of relation. It's like a structure of production that I'm involved with. And so I could see that there was value to something I was doing. I was an important part of the plan. And if I didn't clean those plates up, the next time we had a dinner, they would be messy and the company would lose a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, and it would be my fault. I loved that challenge. And just, you know, I remember, you know, the blasting hot water and all the crazy chemicals and all that kind of stuff. And then having to clean up the kitchen after I was done with the cleaning up the plates, you know, and watching, you know, taking these fire hoses practically and, you know, spraying everything and watching the water rush down the drain at the end and then seeing everything sparkle. Ah! You know, it was just a great night. You know, that was a great time. That was a great time. I love those jobs. And it's really abusive. When I tell kids these stories about my life, you know, that you're doing roofing out in the hot sun or wandering around the organ lofts, you know, with gas masks on because the dead birds that you're walking on are actually like poisonous, you know, because they've been there for like 100 years, you know, the bones of the doves that you're crunching under your feet. And this is exciting stuff. Or carrying pianos up 2 flights of stairs, you know, when I was 14 years old. I mean, this is danger. This is fun. This is adventure, you know. And when I tell people about these stories, they're like, my God, what would I have given to do that instead of sit in my classroom?
But unfortunately, Jeffrey, I think these are stories today that parents tell their kids, and they say, do you know how good you've got it? Do you know when I was 14, I was blasting roast beef off dishes and dragging pianos upstairs? And, you know, this is an unfortunate thing that I think is happening a lot in the adult world, too. People are just... comfort and freedom have become synonymous. And a lot of that comfort, especially that kids have, is very much tied to dependence on their parents. And I think that becomes, you know, when people do the things that you're saying, that you're talking about doing at that age, like even when we were a bit younger, it was because they were in a situation that they needed to get out of. They wanted to be independent. They wanted financial independence. They wanted to be on their own.
Yeah.
You know, that's the only thing that's motivating them today, because they understand that freedom and comfort are not the same thing.
I think it's true that people have told adults that the best thing you can do for your kid is to never let them experience any adversity or any upheaval. Never, they're so fragile, you know, they have to be just comforted all the time. And that's just wrong. I mean, human beings are not that way. We thrive most when we're tested, when we experience instability. We should seek that out. Even as adults, we should seek that out. We should seek out the thing that, you know, that shocks us. We should look for things that disturb us and disorient us and provide dissonance in our lives, because that's what inspires us. That's what inspires creativity and learning. And the minute we stop creating and stop learning, oh, it's just, we might as well be dead.
It's very true with anything, you know, like I've been doing this show for 3 years, right? Yeah. I just get to a point where, like, a year ago, it's like, this is boring. This is just the same thing over. And if a new challenge doesn't come into this,
right,
which we have to create,
yes,
then that was it.
Yeah.
And I always, I found it amazing that people could just do the same thing day in and day out. But comfort is like, comfort, safety, security have become top priorities, and I think school is kind of the villain in that.
It really is. It trains kids from a very early age. And of course, I mean, the old story, you know, people, you know, kids in school until their age 22 or 26 or something like that. I mean, they emerge from that experience never having worked at all. They're barely people at all. They're almost non-functioning, you know. They don't really understand essentially anything about life. I was just remembering something I have to tell you. One of my earliest memories of work was being on a hot roof and doing some roofing.
Yeah.
And I was working with a guy, and we had been up there all morning long, and the sun was beating down. And, you know, we were kind of walking on this ledge, you know, it's kind of curved. It was a curved, it wasn't a flat roof, it was a curved roof. So
yeah,
a little bit dangerous, you know, and you could have slipped at any time. And we had no water or anything like that up there. And we worked from, oh, probably 8 until about 11:30. And it was, I was really, really thirsty. And he said, well, do you think we ought to get down and, you know, get a drink? I said, yes, please. Yeah, let's go. So we climbed down the ladders, and I reached for the garden hose and just like shoved it in my mouth and just
right.
And he said, hey, be careful. You shouldn't be drinking that much water. I can tell you that's going to catch up to you. That could be a real problem. And I was astonished that he wasn't drinking. So we went inside the house. He poured himself a cup of coffee. And that was what he drank. It was so funny. I remember being just startled by that. I thought, man, this man is made of stronger stuff than I am.
And he became your mentor.
Yeah, right. I admired that guy. It was great. But it's good to see the way other people work. You know, you have to work with other people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So from what I've read of yours on, and we didn't even credential you or anything.
Yeah,
you are the executive editor of the
Laissez-faire books.
Laissez-faire books.
And I started the Laissez-faire club. So I'm calling myself the primus inter pares of that, which was a ridiculous title I made up on the spot because I couldn't think of anything else. I'm really, I guess, the founder and the head of the Laissez-faire club, which is a new model for distributing libertarian literature on a commercial basis. So you pay one price. It's like a Spotify for libertarian literature.
Mm-hmm.
You pay one monthly little fee, and then you get everything else is just free downloads. And
oh, terrific.
And there's a community, and, you know, I write book summaries so that it, like, just in case you don't have time to read the book, you can get the main messages from my book summary, so I help you cheat. You know, so I try to serve our members in absurd ways. I provide author interviews and just kind of turn lots of somersaults and things to try to keep people really engaged. So I'm trying to inspire people. That's all.
That's very cool to see. I've been waiting for this kind of interactive book content to start coming out. I mean,
yeah,
it seems ridiculous in this day and age that I can't, you know, pull up a book on my iPad and then, you know, click contextual, you know, videos within the book.
We've made now two of those things. Now these are interactive books. So,
nice.
So that you open. I wish I brought. I have it up in my hotel room. But my book, A Beautiful Anarchy. Now, if you buy it, you can buy it. If you're a member of the club, you get the download so that you can read the book. But then also, I make videos for each chapter. So before you read the chapter, I mean, in the digital book itself, you can just click on play, and I'm talking to you.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really cool. I mean, the first time I saw that, I thought, I can't believe this is really happening. But it, you know, it works, and it's beautiful. Yes.
The
difference between movies and books are like merging or something,
yeah, yeah.
You know.
The other thing I've been waiting to see is user-generated content that's also contextually related to the material. So, yeah. You know, imagine being able to just click a hyperlink within a book and see comments that, you know, people all around the world have just made.
Yeah, yeah. I'm hoping that that is definitely the next step. We're going that direction, I think. Exactly. I mean, all these media are starting to merge a little bit at a time. It's really fun to be involved in this industry, especially with this company I work for, which is very sort of progressive. And they're always willing to try whatever the new thing is. You know, it's, you know, the commerce tends to inspire this kind of creativity. So yeah. They're pretty edgy.
Yeah. But you have a blog on that site as well.
Right? Yeah. And I've been blogging actually since I've been here.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that was actually where I've read a lot of your stuff. And I know from having read through your blog that you're very optimistic about the future. I hope we didn't drag you down with this child labor talk.
No, today. We've got barriers and we have to get rid of them.
Sure.
I'm one of the few people I think that ever even talks about this issue, which seems so incredibly obvious to me. Yeah. I don't know why other people aren't talking about it. Yeah. And in fact, I've been on media appearances in the past where the subject has come up, you know, of work and unemployment and things like that. And I'll be saying, well, we need to get rid of the minimum wage. We need to get rid of labor regulations and cut out this tie between healthcare and business, which raises the cost of employment. And, you know, the host will be agreeing, saying, oh, yeah, this is right. You know, that's all good mainstream opinion. Then I'll add and repeal child labor laws. And they practically want to, like, unplug the mic.
Right.
You know, they're so shocked and mortified that it's like, why would you ruin a perfectly good interview with that absurd comment? You know, that's the look I get.
Yeah. So it's fun to use that momentum of like, yeah, you're right. And then say the principled thing.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, principles.
But I think it's extremely important. It may be more important than anything else. I mean, you've got to, this is a time, you know, young people have an astonishing capacity for learning. You know, it shuts down, you know, after you turn like 20, you know, it starts diminishing, you know, but at that crucial age in the early teen years up until the late teen years, you're just a sponge for everything. You know, that's the time when the kids need to be getting real learning and lessons in life by being out there working. Yeah.
So this is not a problem that's going to be solved in anytime soon. Right. So I'm wondering if there's a way that we can work around the constraints that are on us.
Yeah.
I know, for example, that if you own a family business, you can have your children work for you.
Yeah, and you know, that I worry about that too, because you know, one of the great things about, you know, about getting out there and working in the real world is that, wow, you have some structure of authority that's outside of school and outside of family.
Right.
That's by itself kind of neat. It's like, oh, meet your new boss.
Sure.
Whoa, hi, wow. Mm. You know, hey, this is kind of a cool guy. You know, wow, he knows a lot of neat things. He's got a different way of talking to me than my teachers and my parents do. You know, it's kind of it's neat. It's liberating for you because it gives you another cell in which you're valued besides just the home and school. That's all anybody really knows.
Mm.
It's really terrible. But anyway, it's better than nothing. A home business is better than nothing.
That's why I'm wondering is it possible to buy like 1% of a bread factory and send your kids to work? Does that not count?
Yeah, it doesn't count. You really have to. It has to be. I think the rules are very strict. It has to be family owned, non-public. I mean, these are exceptions made. This has all began in the Great Depression. You know, this is experiment and making kids useless really is fairly new in the world history. You know, it began basically in the New Deal. You know,
sure.
And I mean, FDR had a funny strategy for dealing with unemployment. He just took a ton of people off the labor rolls.
Yeah, right.
And then when that didn't work, he sent them off to be killed, you know, in a war. So
right.
Eventually they got unemployment down. You know, you make it illegal for enough people to work and kill enough people, eventually unemployment falls.
True.
Wasn't this interesting? In our preliminary discussion about this interview on Thursday night, we said, I'm tired of talking about school. And they're going to expect, if we sit down with Jeffrey Tucker, we'll talk a little bit about economics. So let's just blow their minds and not talk about those things. And we're 27 minutes in. It's all we've talked about.
Successfully.
So now what we're going to do is totally change directions.
Okay.
Had a fashion question, right?
Well, I don't know if I had a question, but I figured you were the person to talk to.
No, let's just open it up. People are afraid to talk to me about clothes. I think that's very interesting. Yeah,
that's all I want to talk to you about.
Okay, it's very interesting to me. It's like, you know, it's like this taboo subject or something like that. And look, I'm coming to terms with it, I guess, because I've been told it enough that people say that I seem to, be sort of attentive to what I wear. Maybe I'm not sure how to put it, but people do have a lot of questions, and I think people should ask them, you know.
Right.
I think that I'm not sure what specifically you had in mind, but let me just give this quick preliminary note. And most times and most places in the history of humanity, people have not been free to choose what they wear because of laws. Elizabethan England, it was absolutely illegal to dress above your station in life. Mm. In colonial America, you know, there were very strict sumptuary laws that were mostly dictated by religion that told you what you could wear and what you couldn't wear. Most times in most places, people didn't have choice because there weren't clothes available. You know, you had to wear whatever you had and you were stuck with that. So we are blessed with this extraordinary, and even today, most, you know, fundamentalist Islamic states, you're not allowed to just dress however you want. But in this country and the developed world, we have a vast range of choice. We have freedoms that most people, most times, in most places, would not have. And yet we don't really use those freedoms very well.
No, and it seems like it's almost exacerbated in our community. There's almost like a rejection of trying to look presentable.
Yeah,
it's like, how slovenly can we possibly be?
That's true. It's funny. But you can actually make yourself more valuable by looking better. And you can actually trace men's fashions in particular by the business cycle. I mean, in boom times, people tend to dress down, look a little bit crappy all the time, whatever. But when the bust comes, when jobs become scarce, then people tend to ramp it up a little bit. That's a general tendency that you've seen through the decades.
Just trying to get an edge in the
market. Yeah, you need a little bit of an edge in the marketplace. Yeah.
Well, I think we're speaking to, and we don't want to be overly critical of people here. I mean, there's a lot of young people, a lot of people who came from software where they could just, you know, work from home, work in sweatpants. Mm-hmm. But presentation, especially when you have a message that you want to share with other people, presentation is important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll go to the grocery store in sweatpants, right? But I'm not handing out literature to people while I'm there in sweatpants, unshaven,
right.
You know?
Right.
So obviously different events and different goals for communication have different levels of dress that need to go with it.
I think it's important to remember that we all live within a social context, and much of our personal value is dependent upon how people respond around us, respond to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we want that kind of capacity to sort of, you know, accumulate certain reputational capital and to present ourselves well and have other people respond to it in a favorable way. It makes us more effective as individuals and brightens the world, makes it more beautiful place to live in, I would say. Yeah.
So I read something that you wrote, and so apparently studies show makes people more trustworthy.
Oh, you know, that's an interesting. You read that article that I wrote.
Yeah, what's it? Kids Smarter Than Adults.
That was very interesting because that surprised me very much. So here's this story. Parents are always down on kids for wanting to wear designer labels all the time. You know, it's like, that is just so stupid. I mean, why would you want to replace one blue shirt with another just because, you know, one has, you know, a fancy label on it and the other doesn't? This has a polo, that one doesn't. I mean, adults tend to think that that's an idiotic, irrational choice.
Yeah.
But actually, all the scientific literature shows exactly the opposite. People tend to trust those with designer labels more so than those without. And kids intuit this. And they've done all as close as you can do to controlled experiments showing that people who wear designer clothes are considered to be more trustworthy. They tend to be better salesmen. They tend to be first, you know, given responsibilities and hired more quickly than others. People presume that they're more well-spoken and more intelligent and all this stuff. I mean, and it's it's been tried many different ways. So the kids are the rational ones, really, essentially. They're exactly right to want to.
Well, adult clothes don't even have the label on the outside of the clothes.
This is so funny. Okay, this jacket that I'm wearing, I think it still has tags on it. Hold on, I've owned this for years. I've never worn it in public. Tag.
Calvin, that's why I trust you.
Now, I have always liked this style of jacket, right? Mm-hmm. For dressing casual, you know, it's a casual dress. But I never liked how it says that so prominently.
Yeah, it's advertising.
It's not a brand that I love. Mm-hmm. I can't fit in their jeans. Their jeans are made for very narrow men with little.
Yeah,
I would never
be there.
Yeah, I'm kind of a awkward size for pants for sure, and would really benefit from having a tailor. But so I don't wear a lot of their stuff. I always wear this, like this jacket. Just never took the tag off it. Still don't know if I'm going to bring it back. I'm glad I quit smoking because I still might take it back to Macy's. But Yeah, it's just funny that I was reviewing the article while we were having lunch.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, okay, well, now people will trust me more.
No, it's a very, I was surprised by that because, no, but I think kids are very socially attentive. So they tend to recognize things and know things that adults, you know, consider to be irrelevant, you know. But they're right about this. And it's intriguing to me, too, because you know that the fashion industry is one of the few really thoroughly free market industries we have. Mm. There is no copyright or intellectual property associated with that, with the exception of trademark, right? So you'd think that the whole institution, if IP theory is correct, you know, would just fall apart. You know, there would be, nobody would have the incentive to make new things because piracy is so prevalent. You know, the whole industry would collapse and the first movers wouldn't be able to make enough profits because, you know, the knockoff economy would drive them to zero very quickly and the whole thing would collapse, right? But the exact opposite is true. Yeah, there's knockoffs everywhere. And within hours after the big runway shows, you know, the knockoff pirates get busy to try to, you know, to make the thing and make it available at a tenth the price. But the reason designers are able to charge so much more is because their products are more valuable, actually, to consumers. And why is that? I mean, on one hand, it's not possible to answer the question why, right? Because it's just a fact. This is the way consumers respond to things. They want the real thing rather than the fake thing. We don't always know entirely why, but I'm still very interested in why. So I like to ask, when I meet high school kids, I'll ask them like random questions like, would you ever buy a fake Gucci bag? And they'll say, oh, I'd never do that. Well, why is that? Well, I said, well, what if they're exactly the same and it's like 1/100th the price? Well, leaving aside the problem, you know, that the parents are paying the bill, I mean, there's that fact. But aside from that, I talked to a young girl the other day and she said, I would never have a fake Gucci bag because it's true that you might assure me that the fake Gucci bag is just the same as the real Gucci bag. Absolutely homogeneous. I don't know that really for sure. I don't know. I mean, even to my eye, they may look the same, but there might be some small detail, like a tiny thread, you know, running somewhere that would tip somebody off to the fact that it's fake. Or it might be, this is what she said, it might wear differently. Mm. The fake might wear differently than the real one. And she said it's like a catastrophe.
Yeah.
I mean, you may fool 1,000 people, but then the one person who recognizes the fake, you know, discovers that is truly humiliating.
Sure. You're revealed as a complete and total fraud in everything that you do.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. I don't believe it's because, oh, you know, the stitching pattern is different and I'm a real stickler for the stitching pattern.
No, they're
pattern.
Afraid of discovery.
Right. It's not like, you know, on the imaginary scale of social acceptability that the real Gucci bag is plush 50 and the knockoff is plus 45. The knockoff is potentially negative 1,000.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's exactly it. Had you ever thought about that before? So you have to talk to kids to find out these things. I mean, I never thought about that before, but yeah, it's a catastrophic to be revealed as a fake. Mm-hmm. You know, then it's better that you had no bag at all or bought a non-fake Gucci bag, just something from Walmart or whatever. Yeah.
But I don't understand.
It's too risky.
The clicks then, like the amount of clickiness that I see in high school, which is, there's a lot of fakery involved in being in a clique and kind of all the other conformity that you have to do in life. Now this extra area where you have to be even more specific with certain fashions and saying certain things and thinking certain things. I think that's almost entirely fake. I mean, that was...
Well, maybe it is, but you know, it gives... The good thing about cliques in high school, and I would almost defend them because they teach, at least, I mean, and a time of people's lives are not learning a damn thing otherwise. At least cliques and social groups like that teach people the advantage of sort of being the first mover. And they're very conscious of this. Like, I like this song. You know, this is my favorite song. Here's a good example. You remember the other day, there was this meme online that just like took over instantly called the...
Harlem Shake?
Harlem Shake.
Okay. Oh, it's the best.
Okay. So now... Here's the thing,
amazing.
Though. If you're in a high school clique and nobody knows about the Harlem Shake and you're the first one to know about the Harlem Shake and you're the first one to whip out your smartphone and say, look at the Harlem Shake.
Yeah.
And nobody's heard about the Harlem Shake, you've got high status. Okay. Mm-hmm. But now there's a problem. The second, third, and fourth, and 50th person to know about the Harlem Shake is, you know, not so impressive, right? So then the next step has to be the first person who is tired of the Harlem Shake. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then if you say, you know what, I'm sick of the Harlem Shake. If you're the first person to be sick of the Harlem Shake, then you have the first mover advantage, you know. And maybe there's a third stage. So it's like, you know what, I'm tired of the people who are putting down the Harlem Shake. You know, man, you know, whatever it is. But the
hipsters.
Point is,
yeah. You know what? While everyone's over the Harlem Shake, no, wait, the hipster is either 0 or 3, right? Because 1 is it's cool, 2 is it's not cool, 0 is I knew it was cool before,
right.
4 is I think it's cool, 3 right. is I think it's cool after everyone else thinks it's not.
Right, right.
So hipsters kind of, the hipster yeah. sandwich.
But it's good for kids to practice this pattern of being the first to notice something,
sure.
the first to have an opinion. I mean, how do you make money in markets? So there's only really 3 ways, right? You can be smart, and there's a lot of smart people, so that's difficult. You can cheat, and that's a bad idea. Or you can be first.
Right.
Being first is generally the easiest way to do this.
Yeah.
So the cliques in high school, by the way, that's not my own insight. I take this from this great movie called Margin Call. It's a quotation from the CEO. I love it. But anyway, it's true. So being involved in a clique where being first gives you high status, at least you get practice at that. That's something you're learning anyway. And when you get out into the enterprising world, you can draw on that lesson. I've got to be first to make money. You know this, right?
Absolutely. I mean,
everybody yeah. involved in commerce knows that being first is the key to profitability.
I lend more to the cheating side of things.
So right. this is that.
Because I do think that there's a fourth way.
What?
And that is to seek government favor.
Oh, I forgot about that
right.
part.
Which,
right, bail out.
I think that's kind of lumped in with cheating.
Be bailed out.
Bailed out.
Yeah, that's cheating. So. Yeah, that's cheating. Yeah, that's part of cheating.
But, I mean, obviously, there's so much of business now, today, more than ever, and, well, until probably next year, is tied to you being in the favor of the government, pretty much. It's very hard to pull yourself apart and be completely independent. And, I mean, you think about the amount of contracts and government doesn't do anything or make anything. And I mean, I worked as a recruiter in the past. Everything we did was somehow tied to government. Somehow
really?
Tied to the Defense Department, the
yeah.
Energy Department, all contractors.
Yeah.
And it was a job. I was actually starting a tutoring company at the time, and I thought recruiting was something I could do as the business built. And I quit about 3 months in when we got all of these jobs for something called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Which sounds good, but I was sending people to Savannah River, South Carolina, which is a nuclear waste disposal site. And the guy left his family. I convinced him to leave his family in Colorado for a 1-year contract to go to this shitty place.
Wow.
For $50 an hour.
Yeah.
Where he called me a week later. He said, Brett, I'm sitting here at a desk. I don't know. No one's even told me what to do yet.
He's making the money.
Well, at that point, he thanked me because he had, you know, gotten $2,000.
Uh-huh. But, you know, I just don't know. I think in many ways, and it seems strange for me, you know, this anarcho-capitalist to say this, but I think money is really overrated relative to happiness itself.
I agree.
Yeah. Just making money. If you have to give up your independence, your dignity, you know, if you have to give up anything you love and have to do something you hate, and all you get is a bunch of paper in exchange for that, I don't know that that's a good choice to make.
There's balance, though, because you know
Use the money to buy other kinds of happiness.
Yeah,
so the question is
true.
The happiness you're giving up better than the happiness you're getting?
But it makes me sad to see people just pursuing something for money alone. In fact, you know, great entrepreneurs really oftentimes don't really care that much about money. The money is important as a kind of a ratification of a job well done. You know, it's a sign and a symbol of success. It's something that you bank on and you need as a way of sort of showing you that you're doing the right thing. But the money itself is not the value. The value is making a dent in the universe.
Well, money itself, I would say it's similar to alcohol and hallucinogenics. And let me explain, okay? it's kind of an accelerator. It's kind of a gas pedal, right? So whatever direction you're going in, spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, you're about to arrive a lot faster. You know, if it's booze, psychedelics, or money, right. you know, that you're adding to that mix. So, I mean, we hear all these tragic stories of people who come into all this money and 2 years later they're dead.
Oh, it happens all the time. And, you know, it happens sometimes with young people too. And this is something that your audience might be interested in because people oftentimes will get a first job out of college.
Yeah.
And it pays them more. They're always surprised by how much it pays, actually, because in college they've been kind of living hand to mouth or whatever, you know. And then they get their first job, and let's say it pays, you know, 50, 60, something like that. And they're like, holy, you know, I've got a lot of money. They're single. They don't have any other responsibilities. And they ramp up their lifestyles very quickly to match that level of income and then leverage it after that. And then a year later find they don't like that job. And then they're stuck.
Yeah.
They don't know what to do then. So I always recommend to people that you should never ramp up your lifestyle beyond your second best employment opportunity. No matter what job you have, think about what you would be doing if you didn't have that job and how much that would pay you, and only live at that level.
Yeah.
Because
sure.
otherwise you lack the choice. And here's another thing. We live in a world that's changing very radically, very quickly and in surprising ways every day. You really want to be in a position that even if you're paid if you have got a really good job and it pays a lot of money, you want to be in a position to be able to walk away from that job and accept something at a far lower pay and get on the ground floor of something that's new and enterprising that later will be even more rewarding at a future time. But you have to be in a position to be able to do that, meaning that you'll be spending everything you're making, much less spending everything you're making on debt you're paying, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, people should generally try to take about a third of their income and pretend like they're not making it, you know?
Right. That
way you're in a position to be able to be mobile, to be free, to accept lower pay on a prospect of earning more later. You know,
especially when you're young, if you, instead of going to college, if you start working when you're 16, 18 years old, I mean, you can still live at home. Most people can for 5 or 6 years.
It's a good idea.
Save that money. I mean, you'd be so far ahead of the game.
It's so much ridiculous. Better than going into college debt. You know, I don't know why. I mean, people probably should take a year or two off if you're going to go to college and get out there and work. And that gives you a chance to assess whether or not this is a good expenditure of 4 years, you know, going forward. Maybe you should just, you know, find ways to make it just on your own. And at least, you know, you can accumulate some income and avoid the college debt, which is just absolutely oppressive. So what are we doing to our kids if we're destroying their lives?
Yeah,
really?
It's terrible.
I'm sorry.
So the objection you always hear to that strategy is, once you take time off, you'll never go back to college. You'll just never go.
Yeah, people do say that. Maybe that's not a bad thing.
I know. That's what I'm saying. That's a great thing. You decided, hey, this is not for me.
Yeah. I remember my dad saying, you know, you're going to get a job where you make $10 an hour. You'll think you're rich and you'll never go. And I graduated from college. I was unemployed, making negative $75 an hour. If we broke down what I owed, and that was obviously that job market isn't even comparable to what it is today.
Right.
I mean, I graduated from college in the year 2000.
Yeah.
So I mean, we were at the end of one thing, but we were recovering. I think
possible. When I entered Texas Tech, I graduated from high school early and just went right to college, and I had two jobs. Really, I was playing for a jazz ensemble late at night, and we would start playing about 10 and quit playing about 2, you know, and then I would go home and sleep about 4 hours and wake up and get to study and start classes, you know, at 8 and go until noon and then go to a retail shop that I managed until it closed down at, you know, like 6 or 7 o'clock, you know, and just try to squeeze studying in there. So I had two jobs plus full-time work, you know, which was insane, really. But I was, you know, trying to support myself, and I never wanted to take a dime from my parents, you know. I think that a lot of people had that attitude in those days. I'm not going to live off mom and dad, you know. Now, how could anybody, you know, help do that? You have to. You're dependent on somebody, you know. You're going to be taking out student loans or begging mom and dad for help, and it's real sad.
So, unfortunately, we're out of time.
Okay.
Oh, my well, gosh. I wish you were our co-host. That was amazing. That was so good. You know, we always got a third chair, so if you're ever in town, you can certainly sit in it. Can you just give us a plug one more time for everything?
I mean, everybody should join. I think people should be joining the Laissez-Faire Club. It's $10 a month, and you get all these books, and I'm writing now book summaries every week to help you kind of get through literature, and it curates the literature and helps people allocate their time well in terms of reading. There's no shortage of stuff to read, but you know, there's a shortage of people to guide our reading, you know, and that's really what I'm trying to do with this thing. So that's and it's you can get to it by going to lfb.org.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And I hope you have a good time for the rest of the weekend.
Thanks. Love being here.
All right, great.
All right. So it was a good podcast.